Welcome back to the program. Imagine if you could say things and interact with people unrestricted by conscience. If you had an unfettered capacity for risk, engaged in irresponsible behavior, and felt it unnecessary to conform to social norms. For this to happen, two things are usually true. Either you're a politician or a sociopath, or maybe even a trial lawyer. And then imagine if these things could be combined. Then you would have my guest, Emmy Thomas. She's a trial lawyer, a law professor, and an admitted sociopath. In her just-published memoir, Confessions of a Sociopath, she shows us that all sociopaths are not Hannibal Lecter, but they do have many of the same traits. It is my pleasure to welcome Emmy Thomas to the program today to talk about Confessions of a Sociopath, A Life Spent Hiding in Plain Sight. Emmy Thomas, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you here. We should say at the outset that you wrote this under a pseudonym, under a pen name. Talk a little bit about the decision to do that. You're out there openly talking about this. Talk a little bit about the thought process that went into doing this in the first place and doing it under a pen name.
Yeah, that's a very interesting. I guess it all started with writing a blog. I wrote a blog, and I wrote it anonymously, I guess for obvious reasons. Sociopaths are not the most well-loved group of people. In fact, they might actually be the most hated group of people on the planet, possibly. So I had an anonymous blog that I started writing in the late aughts, 2008, 2009. And I had started writing the blog because I was dealing with some very difficult life circumstances. I had just been fired from a very prestigious job. I had a bunch of relationships end around that same time. And I remembered during it, you know, I kind of thought, what's going on here? What's going wrong with my life? And I had remembered a casual diagnosis that a friend had made of me, 5 years earlier, that maybe you're a sociopath. You know, it sounds like you're a sociopath. So I started looking into it, and I noticed that there wasn't a lot of information that was very positive about sociopaths. Even the scientific information, even the psychologist studies, seemed to be very biased in talking about all the negative aspects of sociopaths. So I started writing a blog, and it was anonymous, and eventually I was contacted about, you know, would I be interested in writing a book and sort of continuing what I had envisioned for the blog, which was to advocate on behalf of this particular disorder and at least start a conversation. You know, what is this disorder? Is it exactly what we thought it was? You know, put a face to it. And in order to put a face to the disorder, I had to disclose certain personally identifying pieces of information about me. I wanted to give a, a complex portrait of somebody who actually has this disorder rather than a list of traits that they might have that would qualify them for a diagnosis. And to do that, you know, I had to be sort of a little bit out. So the choice is to stay anonymous and not have my real name be associated with the book as much as possible. But I am also willing and able to identify myself in particular situations. If people email me via my blog, then I can identify myself. And the choice to remain anonymous essentially is to protect my family, who have really done nothing to bring on them this sort of, potential for criticism to their lives, particularly my little relatives, my nephews and nieces.
I want to come back to a point you made earlier about sociopaths being perhaps the most hated people in society. Aside from the fear of criminal behavior that certainly may grow out of that, talk a little bit about why you think they are so hated. And to what extent does it come from the fact that sociopaths are easily able to do the things that people dream that they could do if only conscience didn't get in the way?
Right. That's interesting that you say that, because one of my friends, you know, read the book and identified me and then wrote me and saying at first I had a little bit of a problem, but then as somebody who feels guilt too readily, you know, I started actually being jealous of the way that you approach life. So I don't know if that's why they're hated. You know, it's actually kind of interesting. At first I thought they're hated because they're misunderstood. You know, they have these predilections, right? But as long as they're doing kind of roughly good things, is that enough? And a lot of people have told me, no, they're hated because, yes, they're people are afraid of sociopaths because they're not able to identify them, right? So a lot of questions I get is, how can I know if I am in a relationship with a sociopath, or how can I know if there's a sociopath at work, or give me tips on how to spot a sociopath? And I can give people some tips, but my main thought is it's not really that big of a concern. You know, the fear of sociopaths, it's not as if sociopaths aren't real and can't be dangerous. That's true, but the nature and the quantity or the severity of the danger, I think, has been sort of grossly overstated, particularly when you're talking about sociopaths like me, who just live and act in society, successful sociopaths, sometimes psychologists call them, without, you know, being ever in prison, right? So I think when it comes to being afraid of sociopaths and wanting to take precautions to avoid interacting with sociopaths, it's a little bit like being afraid of a shark attack when you're getting ready to take a beach vacation. It's possible. It's possible it's going to happen to you, and maybe it's a good idea to learn some safety measures anyways, precautions, you know, and obviously swim with a buddy or whatever else it is, but it's probably not going to happen to you. I think that you have a greater chance of being struck by lightning than you have of being the victim, at least the violent victim, victim of violence from a sociopath.
Of course, part of it is the uncertainty. To use your shark analogy, we don't know when that shark has fed last, just as we don't know,
right,
with sociopaths when or what may cause them to cross that line. I mean, you talk about not having engaged in criminal behavior, but what is that line, and could you cross it?
Yeah. So what is that line? You know, it's very interesting. I think it kind of depends on the sociopath. I think largely sociopathy is not necessarily misanthropic. It's not necessarily sadistic. It's not necessarily malicious. Sociopaths don't necessarily hate people or want to hurt people. That's not actually an element of the disorder. Some people are, you know, naturally sadistic or want to hurt people. You know, some people, I guess, are evil. That's not necessarily what sociopathy means. Basically, sociopathy is just this lack of guilt, this lack of remorse. You don't have, and, you know, it sounds kind of horrible, but it's not just lack of guilt and lack of remorse. It's basically a lack of having emotional decision-making at all. You know, so when we feel guilty, that guilt helps us make a decision. But for sociopaths, they rarely make emotionally-based decisions. You know, with the possible exception of when they are very angry, and then it's just very impulsive behavior, just like everybody else. People get road rage and get very angry and impulsive about things. But sociopaths, they don't have this sort of emotion, and so it's not as if they don't have anything controlling their behavior, though. You imagine, you know, what lines do most people not cross, and what are the reasons why they don't cross those lines? For a lot of people, it's guilt. Right? For a lot of people, it's guilt, and you would feel bad if you did a particular thing to somebody. You would feel bad if you hurt somebody. For other people, it could possibly be their religion. They have particular lines that they're not going to cross because of their religion or because their other ethical beliefs, etc. But you imagine, let's say you take away these feelings of guilt. You know, so imagine this scenario. You hate your neighbor. If you could, you would like to kill your neighbor for whatever reason. Maybe it's justified, whatever reason you'd like to kill your neighbor. And you don't do so because your religious beliefs. You say, okay, thou shalt not kill. I'm not going to kill my neighbor, right? Then one day you have this sort of epiphany. You stop believing. You become an atheist. You know, you realize God doesn't exist and that, therefore, there's no longer the commandment that's been restraining you from killing your neighbor. There's no longer thou shalt not kill. You don't believe in it anymore. Does that mean the very next thing that you're going to do is walk over to your neighbor's house and kill him? Not necessarily. Just because your dominant or sort of predominant reasons for not doing a particular thing exist doesn't mean that there aren't sort of sub-reasons why you might do something. You know, for a sociopath, then, just because we don't feel guilt doesn't mean that there are no lines or barriers. It means that we define those lines or barriers in different ways. We define them rationally. Sometimes we come up with a convenient sort of code. My convenient code, sort of prosthetic moral compass, is efficiency. For the most part, if I'm doing things that are efficient for me and efficient for society, are generally maximizing the general utility, so utilitarian, that tends to map on roughly to what most people think is morally correct. And for the most part, I would like to, you know, conform to society and be doing things that are morally correct because that ends up being the best result for me. If I'm constantly violating social norms, if I'm constantly breaking laws, then I would be in prison. I wouldn't be able to walk about as freely as I do. So I understand that's sort of the social contract that we all engage in. That's the exchange. I just don't do it for the exact same reasons that everybody else does. I do it for very sort of rational reasons, whereas other people might do it because they're worried about feeling guilt.
But the rational reasons, in a way, are wrapped up in the sociopathy, because one of the things you talk about is the risk-taking behavior and power for its own reward. And if you do something or commit an act that in some way limits your power by putting you behind bars or limiting you in some way, that runs counter to the way the sociopathy works. So it becomes sort of self-limiting in some respects.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And the sociopaths who visit my blog and who have emailed me, this is kind of a continuing theme with a successful sociopath, is that they understand that the greatest power you can have is power over yourself. And until you really master your own self and are able to sort of control or predict your own behavior, you're really not going to be able to get any sort of power in the greater society.
Talk a little bit about the evolution of this for you. You mentioned religion before. You were brought up, I mean, you went to Brigham Young University. Religion was around you. You still consider yourself part of the Mormon Church. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. People are very complicated. There are a lot of factors that go in. And sociopathy, the origin of sociopathy is also very complicated. Twin studies, genetic studies that suggest that there's something genetic about it. And then whatever else it is, environmental, that triggers it, you know, there's also a role for that. So I was raised in a Mormon family, right? But it was also unstable, particularly during my early years. Eventually it sort of stabilized and everything is fine, right? But particularly during my early years, it's an unstable environment. And probably the worst thing for a sociopath is sort of unpredictable. It's an unpredictable environment. So it seems like there are no rules, or the rules that there are sort of worthless. You know, there's a hypocrisy going on. And so I was never really taught to respect certain people's emotional worlds, right? Because the emotional worlds of others just seem to me to be maudlin displays for the use of manipulation. So that's kind of what I learned, is that emotions are for manipulating others. But then I had also gone all of these years to Sunday school in the Mormon Church, and learn these things about, you know, be nice to others, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, the golden rule, and had been sort of sensitized to this idea of serving others and that other people are really important. In the Mormon faith, there's this sort of idea that everybody is very valuable and they're all our brothers and sisters and that we should care for them as much as we should care for ourselves because they are so valuable. So I think that I also had in my mind this idea that humans were special and that humans were something that I should take care of the same way that I would take care of a very valuable toy that I liked, right? So I kind of had these dual things going on. And so I think that's why probably I am not as malicious with my traits. I don't understand people well, particularly when I was a small child. There are aspects of people that I don't understand well at all. I'm sort of a savant that way. There are certain things that I see about people very well, very clearly, and there are other things that I struggle with. You know, I don't have the same sort of empathy that would give me the basic understanding of what it's like for somebody else to be the way that they are, to live the life that they live. So there's also this struggle of, you know, on the one hand, I'm not trying to be malicious. You know, I just have these sorts of impulses, and I see people as people that are valuable, but I also don't naturally see people the way that most people see them. I'm not able to really put myself entirely into their shoes. And so I think that's kind of a weird twist to my own sort of development as a sociopath. You know, whatever triggered it genetically, perhaps through my paternal grandfather, right? And then whatever triggered it environmentally, with my unstable upbringing, particularly when I was young, but never really being able to indulge or being taught to indulge or kind of appreciate violence in any particular way. but on the other hand, or contrary to that, being taught to respect others, you know, being taught that other people were these valuable things that we should sort of watch after. And so I think, you know, that's a weird combination of traits to have in a sociopath. I don't think I'm a prototypical sociopath by a long shot.
Part of it is the degree to which any sociopath, I suppose, acts on those impulses you're talking about. And it does seem like it goes along two separate paths. One is about the emotion or lack of emotion, and the other is the moral component that we're talking about before. And sometimes they're interrelated, and sometimes they aren't.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting. And, you know, for a lot of people, I think that they're just always related, right? Your emotions and the morality of things always sort of link up. And for me, it's very obvious. The most obvious ways that I think differently exist in these sort of gaps, you know, where I am following what I think is sort of ethically right, and other people are responding to their gut reactions that something's wrong. So I use this example in the book, talking about in law school, where we learn to think like lawyers, and we're learning to think, you know, here's what's just and here's what's best for the system. And we learn all these rules. And then after we learn them, the teachers would sort of test us, you know, how well can you keep applying these rules in these very sort of emotionally fraught situations like abortion or rape or murder? And suddenly people, you know, would just abandon all these sort of ethical principles we had learned, these rules about what is and is not justice. And all they wanted to do was, you know, just lock these people away forever. You know, pedophiles is a very good example of where people can understand, yes, we want certain protections for people. But when you really hate somebody or hate what that person does, when you have very strong emotions about whatever it is that that person is doing, then it's very easy to sort of trample on their rights. It's very easy for you to sort of abandon what your rational reasons for ethics that you had before. And I actually have, it's interesting, as sort of this coming out experience, I've been experiencing that a lot. You know, I have done no wrong to most people in my life. I've, you know, the vast majority of people, I have done nothing wrong to them. If anything, I've just been, you know, a good friend. I've been a good colleague. I've been a good employee. You know, whatever my role is, I've just been good. But now to have all of my actions being second-guessed, and people just find, you know, what I am to be despicable. And so they treat me as, they objectify me, and they treat me as less than human, because there's something that they just are having an emotional reaction, this gut reaction that is sort of disgust. And there's nothing really that I can say rationally to say, you know, hey, look, I haven't really done anything wrong, particularly not to you, that would change their mind about this particular reaction.
But certainly there are stories you tell, like the story about Lucy and the boyfriend, that I think would rub people the wrong way, to say the least.
Right. And I can understand that, and I'm not saying that I shouldn't be held accountable for my actions. I'm not trying to eschew in any sort of way responsibility or say, I don't even think, you know, sociopaths who are accused of a crime, I don't even necessarily think it should be a mitigating factor in their sentencing, which a lot of people do, a lot of scientists, psychologists do. You know, sociopaths have less ability to control their behavior in certain ways, right? In a lot of ways, we mitigate punishment when people have less ability to control their behaviors. A very good example that is for every normal person is what happens if you walk in on your spouse cheating on you and you kill your spouse, right? We sort of understand as a society that you have limited ability to control your behavior in that situation, that it's such an unusual situation or whatever else it is, that we think that it's sort of reasonable in a way for you to kill your spouse. Although that's really absurd when you think about it. Why should that be a justified killing? You know, are you in any way self-defense? You know, there's no sort of reason why it should be justified, except for the fact that it happens. It happens, and we understand here's a person who normally wouldn't kill somebody, but they're put in a situation in which, yeah, they are now sort of predisposed to killing somebody. So we say, okay, you know, we're going to mitigate the sentence for this and give them less time than we otherwise would, right? So a lot of people suggest we should do the same with sociopaths. Sociopaths have a limited ability to control themselves in particular situations, and so we should factor that into the sort of punishments they get. I don't even necessarily believe that. I think that sociopaths, you know, if you set the structure up and they can't conform to society, let's try to accommodate them if it's possible. But sociopaths can't just use a disorder as a free pass to be able to do whatever they want. I understand that. But, you know, and do sociopaths naturally sort of do bad things? You know, you mentioned the example I tell in the book, a couple stories in which I do bad things. Are those bad things? Yeah, they're bad things. Should I suffer consequences for them? Yeah, I should suffer consequences for them, just like everybody else. Does everybody else also do bad things? Do most normal people, you know, daily do bad things? Does anyone ever intentionally hurt somebody else? I think everybody has intentionally hurt somebody else at one point or another. Maybe because you got mad, maybe because you felt like they did something to you. But I don't think it's so abnormal. The descriptions of my behaviors, it's not that they are so different in severity. I think they're just different in kind. People sit there reading my stories and they think, this is something I would never do. This person, you know, I'm chilled to the bone that this person would sort of think about people in this way. But I am also a little bit disturbed about the way that normal people think about people. You know, when we talk about love as if it's such this great thing, but love kills. You know, when people get love, when they fall in love, they behave in all sorts of different ways. You know, they walk in on their cheating spouse and they kill them. You know, I think that that's disturbing. I think that's chilling.
One of the things people would argue is that given that you are so self-aware of all of this and so profoundly cognizant of it, as is evident in our conversation, why is it an ongoing issue for you? Why aren't you dealing with it in more treatable ways?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And it's something that I've sort of struggled with. I would have liked to have sort of left this behind, I think, if I could. The older I get, the more I realize that it keeps affecting me negatively. You know, every few years still, my life just falls apart. You know, every few years still, I end up in situations, problems with friends, can't communicate. I still have not been able to maintain any sort of long-term romantic relationship. The older I get, the less likely it seems like I'm ever going to get married and have a stable marriage and have children, a stable, any sort of family situation. So, yes, it does affect my life in various ways. My current experiment is, what if I'm just more honest? What if I'm more honest with people? The benefit is towards me. You know, they have to deal with my honesty, right? People don't necessarily want you to be constantly honest. Do I look fat? Yes, you look fat, right? But the benefit is to me in that if I'm more honest and I don't have to pretend as much as I currently do around people, if I'm able to sort of just be myself around people more, maybe that is going to be more authentic seeming to me. Maybe if I'm being constantly honest, I won't have sort of the stress of constantly keeping up appearances in front of people. And maybe if I'm honest, I will have a greater ability to form intimate relationships with people. Because when you're sort of always constantly pretending to be something, when you're sort of always wearing a mask, even when people say that they love you, that they respect you, that they think that you're a good person, these statements don't really have any sort of meaning, because what they're really saying is they love your mask. They respect the mask that you wear around them. They think that the mask that you wear is functionally a good person. So it doesn't really, there's not the same sort of sense of intimacy that you might have if you weren't constantly pretending. So my hope is, particularly with the book, to try to explore this more, to see, does this help? You know, I don't know. Does it help to be more honest? Does it help for me to live kind of a more authentic life with everybody? Not just the people who are very most close to me, but in general, you know, does it help for me to be able to feel like I'm more a part of society and not just this fraud walking around them pretending to be something constantly? You know, will that make me more invested in society and more invested in my personal relationships?
Part of the problem is that the sociopathy throws people off balance, and maybe the intimate relationship has to be with another sociopath.
Yeah, people have suggested that before. That's possible. I have met sociopaths before, and it seems like that might work. The problem with most sociopaths is that we don't have very good relationship skills. we're pretty good at manipulating. We're pretty good at sort of fulfilling people's needs. We're pretty good at putting on a good face and putting on a good show, but we don't necessarily have the sorts of emotional attachments, like the emotional glue that keeps most relationships together. You know, we largely, even though we can like people, we like people because of the way that they make us feel or because of the role that they have in their lives. It's sort of this respect and gratitude is what we mean by love for the most part. So if you have two sociopaths, you know, is there enough, you know, normal people, I guess, just like and they just bond and there's that bond that stays there forever. Two sociopaths, will you have that same sort of bond? I think it's possible for two sociopaths to be in a relationship, but it does seem like it would be more difficult.
Emmy Thomas, the book is Confessions of a Sociopath, A Life Spent Hiding in Plain Sight. I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.